Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Christopher Webb, and he's back with a bang. Well, a series of athletic and frankly implausible bangs. It's Robert Johnson.
Hello. Hello.
Hello, welcome back.
Thank you, it's lovely to be back.
And congratulations once more on your new arrival. Well, not so new anymore, but congratulations on him anyway.
Thank you. Yes, last time we spoke was the day of his birth, actually.
That's right, Tango and Cash, yes.
And he'll be 3 months old tomorrow, so it's been that
That's
long.
That's amazing. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, you haven't missed anything. I haven't really been up to much since you've been away. I've kept things quiet.
Don't lie. You promised me when I went on podcast parental leave that your episodes in my absence would be shit. You've lied. You've betrayed me. They've all been bloody good.
I tried my best to make them shit, but the guests just wouldn't allow it. They were really, really great. So thank you to them.
Yeah, no, really, really impressive lineup. Yeah. I feel like Blake and Blake Seven, you know, that's in the last sort of season when he sort of comes back, and Avon's just fucking the main guy now. And
so you're more like Bobby Ewing in the shower.
Yeah, totally.
The last 3 months has been a crazy dream. There is another reason to celebrate because, believe it or not, it's our third birthday.
Are you shitting me? Is it really?
Yeah. By the time this goes out, it will be 3 years. Since the Krull episode went out.
I didn't get you a present. Oh, wow, 3 years.
I know, amazing, eh?
It is amazing. Someone, I was listening to something today and they mentioned Bernard Breslau and I was thinking about Krull.
I do too. Whenever I see on Twitter anyone slyly reference a film that we've reviewed, I just have to paste in a link to it to try and get some listeners. It doesn't work. Yeah. I think we just get blocked, but one day we'll get more listeners.
No, it's fantastic to be back. I'm very happy to be back from podcast parental leave and back in action.
As lovely as the other guests were, it's nice to see a familiar face.
Albeit slightly puffy and tired, unkempt, bedraggled
you
face.
You do look a little unkempt. I don't know, have you had a haircut since lockdown? You're looking very wavy on top there.
Obviously, in lockdown, no haircuts happening. I was like, you know, I'm kind of liking this, getting this length back. And so,
because I remember you from, God, 10, 11 years ago when you had longer, slightly frizzier hair, when you had that Roland Orzabal from Tears for Fears look.
Yes. Part Susan Sarandon, part Orlando Bloom.
Those were the days, yeah. Those were the days when I actually had hair as well. It was crazy days.
You've got a nice tuft on the, top. It's looking quite, it's actually looking quite voluminous.
If I tip my head back, I look like Mr. T. Just a little tuft on top of my head. I'm doing that now. I'm just lifting my head back so Rob can see it.
It's
the crazy fool that I appear.
God, you actually look like Danny Boyle a bit. Off topic, but you,
do you remember that face recognition app where they said, what celebrities do you look like if you put your face in? I came out as Danny Boyle.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he's not a bad looking chap.
No, he's all right. Apart from that Beatles shit he did, he's okay.
Yeah, well, you know, let's not go into his back catalogue of films, but he's done some crackers.
Crackers. Anyway, speaking of some crackers, it was your choice. That was the worst segue I've ever done, but it's your choice. You're back, so you can choose first. So what have we got?
It is my choice indeed. You know, I'm not entirely sure why I picked this one, but I was 11 years old when this came out, and it very quickly took on a mythic status for my peer group and boys older than me, because it was just hugely controversial. It was a pre-internet time, yet it just through word of mouth, you had to see this film.
Yes.
I first saw it, a group of my friends snuck round to one of my mates' places after school. They'd had a VHS copy. We all sat around in hushed tones in the lounge as he put it on. It was an uncomfortable watch, if I'm honest. But the film that I'm referring to is the 1992 erotic neo-noir Basic Instinct.
So we got 31 stab wounds.
What was it?
Ice pick.
I'd like to speak to a Miss Catherine Trammell, please.
Is she a suspect?
She's a writer. She published a novel. It's about a retired rock and roll star who gets murdered by his girlfriend.
You know how she does the boyfriend? With an ice pick.
She intended the book to be her alibi.
You didn't feel anything for him, you just had sex with him for your book.
In the beginning, he gave me a lot of pleasure.
You like playing games?
Games are fun.
What's your new book about?
A detective. He falls for the wrong woman.
What happens?
She kills him. How's it feel to kill someone?
You tell me.
You're in over your head.
She seduces people. She manipulates people. She is evil!
Freeze!
I have nothing to hide.
You playing a game here?
I'm pretty gone!
Games are over.
Basic Instinct. Now, this isn't the first erotic neo-noir that you've chosen, is it?
No,
I remember some time
not.
Ago we did Body Double.
We did, and again, that was a very much a Hitchcockian suspense thriller with added... With sort of explicit sex in it. This is basically what Paul Verhoeven's...
Verhoeven.
Paul. It's basically what Paul... has done in 1992, I would say with a less slavishly mimicking approach than De Palma does. He's pretty much kept his own Verhoevian style, but certainly ramped up the sleaze, the violence, but it kept a pretty elegant, classy kind of tinge to it as well. Very, very Hitchcockian elements.
Yeah, there's certainly some similarities to old Hitchcock films. You know, the opening, very, very long tracking shot.
Yeah.
The femme fatale who is blonde, which leads a lot to Hitchcock, but also, you know, the old sort of 1930s, 1940s film noir as well. Mm.
The San Francisco setting.
It is very similar to Vertigo, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, very similar to Vertigo. In fact, in the famous interrogation scene, which I'm sure we'll come to, Sharon Stone has the same hairstyle as Kim Novak. From Vertigo at the time, so...
I nearly did a very childish giggle then, sorry.
On her head.
My head, yes.
I know, it's going to be a struggle for it not to be that kind of podcast, isn't it, tonight?
Yeah, I don't want to be the giggling schoolboy ones, because I think there's plenty to talk about that doesn't involve that, so we'll certainly try.
Well, listeners, to be fair, we giggle throughout most of our episodes, so... Yeah. It would just be weird not to giggle through this one. It could be even creepier if we didn't.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, I certainly intend to giggle. I don't want to talk about this one with a straight face. But for me, I was 21 when this came out.
Okay.
I was a student, so we saw it on VHS as well. We were a house of mainly young men.
Mm-hmm.
And very much like you, it was... Oh, it's got to be the one to watch. Some people say they're doing it for real. Yeah. You have to see it. You have to see it. You've never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I was slightly underwhelmed
the
first time I saw it. I just thought it was a bit silly.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the intention. I don't know. We'll discuss that as well. Mm. But I hadn't seen it since then. I'd never seen repeats of it on TV when they've been on. I've never got it out of the video shop.
Yeah.
So interesting to watch it again.
It was interesting to watch it again. It's funny because, you know, at the time, it did feel like... It was 90% sex, and you know, they're just really just full-on sex scenes. And watching it back, the sex scenes are certainly the most tedious parts of the movie.
They are really boring.
Really boring. They're very just sterile, kind of softcore, kind of. They don't feel like particularly realistic. It's not like Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie in Don't Look Now, which feels like a real sex scene, right? They just feel very, almost like a sort of an old Sky One sort of.
I know we'll talk about this more as we go along, and we are getting ahead of ourselves. There's a lot of discussion about whether this is meant to be a titillating for crikey or a satire of titillating for crikey.
Well, the thing, it's hard, isn't it? Because it's difficult to take yourself back to 1992 because obviously this spawned a whole lot of imitators, a lot of erotic thrillers that kind of came out afterwards. Prior to this, I'm trying to think of similar, obviously there's Fatal Attraction, not just because of Michael Douglas, but also because there was that kind of raunchy aspects to it.
It was a bit grubby. Yeah.
So was it being kind of ironic at that time, or was it such a trailblazer in presenting sexuality on the screen in that way? It's hard to know. And then, of course, you look at the next collaboration between Paul Verhoeven and Joe Esterhaas, the screenwriter, which was Showgirls, of course, which Basic Instinct was got mixed reviews from critics, but was a box office smash, whereas Showgirls just was a notoriously one of the worst kind of films of all time.
Which it isn't.
It's actually, if you watch it ironically, it's quite an entertaining romp. But at the time, Paul Verhoeven and Joe Eustace said we kind of deliberately tried to make this a bit satirical and a bit silly. And I know Joe Eustace also at the time said that, you know, there's probably a bit of hubris involved. We'd just come off this massive smash with Basic Instinct, and maybe we could try and see how far we could kind of push things. You know, that is a deliberate attempt at a piss-takey kind of film.
Yeah, because Paul Verhoeven is very good at that.
He's very good at that.
He'll present a film as one thing, but it's actually satirizing that thing. Best examples are, of course, Robocop and Starship Troopers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes very heavily misunderstood. Yeah. I think Showgirls falls into that category as well. Yeah. I think it is deliberately thumbing its nose at that kind of Vegas glorification of women.
Yeah.
And this, possibly the same thing, you know, he is actually satirizing those kind of erotic thrillers. Mm. And the fact that the saucy scenes in this are particularly over the top and boring sort of adds some kind of support to that.
Yeah, I love Paul Verhoeven's, many of his films. I mean, even going back to Flesh and Blood with Rutger Hauer and Jennifer Jason Leigh, I kind of saw that when I was too young to watch it, and I thought, oh shit, this is quite interesting. And, you know, absolutely love Robocop, it's a classic. Really enjoyed Total Recall, love Starship Troopers. I enjoyed Black Book, his sort of return to...
Black Book's really good, good.
Hollow Man was a bit of a misfire. So, you know, I mean, he's a fantastically talented filmmaker, and is, you know, he can present these really lurid, vivid images, and he does like chucking in the violence. He does like chucking in a bit of, at face value, seems a bit B-grade. But like you say, you know, Starship Troopers, I think, is the ideal example of just that send-up of fascistic American militant glamorous behavior in him, and he does it in such a po-faced way that a lot of people went over their heads at the time.
Oh, absolutely. But also in things like Robocop and Starship Troopers, and this is kind of relevant, he presents nudity in a very uninteresting, very untitillating kind of way. Yeah. There's that shower scene in Starship Troopers, there's the changing room scene, and it's just, oh, it's very, very dull, and it's very, very part of the furniture. Mm. Even things like the sexuality in Robocop, where it's very well reported that Nancy Allen, he kept making a cut of hair shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yeah.
So not to make a very sort of overtly sexual character.
Yeah.
So I'd like to think he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? He's clever. He's a very, very clever filmmaker. You know, of course, this was highly controversial at the time. It was on track to get the dreaded NC-17 rating, and he ended up, I think, cutting sort of 40 or 50 seconds off it and changing the angles of some shots to get the rating back down. And the other crazy thing to think about is that the script sold for a record $3 million at the time, just on spec.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you think that while we think there's a possibility that Paul Verhoeven is doing this with his tongue in his cheek and there's a little bit of satire thrown in, do we think that Joe Eustace isn't doing it that way? Bearing in mind some of the subsequent scripts that he's written, like Sliver and Jade.
Yeah, yeah.
There's not a hint of irony in those.
No, I think that could be the case. I mean, Joe Eustace and Showgirls, he is the one out of the two of them who keeps pushing the fact that it was deliberately a comedy, saying things like, you know, how could you think a line like, you know, how does it feel not to have people coming on you anymore? How could you think that that wasn't deliberately comic?
But he would say that. When people start laughing, you go, oh, it was a joke, it was a joke. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we need to punch this one up a bit, Joe.
Yeah.
Give it a bit of a polish. No pun intended.
Oh.
I think he was picturing something a little bit more subtle, perhaps, played very straight, than what we got in this film. It's a very interesting film, isn't it? You could get rid of all the sex and it would just be quite a straightforward suspense thriller. The thing that really sets it apart, other than what was shocking at the time, sex, is the performance, I think, of Sharon Stone, who, you know, was the absolutely star-making performance.
Yeah, I think she's remarkable in it. I think she's so good in it.
She's so cool in it. I knew her when I was a kid watching this. I had known her from Baby with William Catt and a really bad animatronic Brontosaurus. The other was Alan Quatermain and The Lost City of Gold.
Of course, Richard Chamberlain.
I'd seen Total Recall, but I kind of hadn't clicked that she was the wife.
Yeah,
and you know, that was also a really good little supporting role that she had in that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, she's great in that. But she's a really interesting actor in that. Just looking at her awards, which when I do my homework, I look on IMDb. She's won a shitload of Golden Globes, but also won a shitload of Razzies. And you know my opinions on the Razzies anyway.
Yeah.
But just that kind of divisive career is, I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, well, this role, I think it totally made her as a star, but it kind of undid her a little bit as well, because she was a little bit typecast as the femme fatale, or the, you know, the one who get her boobs out in a big budget picture. And then it probably didn't help that she went on to do Sliver, written by Joe Eastlehouse, which really did not have probably the lofty artistic ambitions of Basic Instinct. It was just
it was just a lot grubbier.
The
word grubby comes into it, yeah.
Even her role in Casino, which was a brilliant performance, she was Oscar nominated for it, but even that was kind of like the femme fatale in a way, you know? I don't want to diss her career, because she's had a pretty interesting career and obviously achieved some amazing success, but just don't think she ever had the range of like a Meryl Streep or a Nicole Kidman, and probably just took a few paychecks when, you know, she maybe could have. But who knows what script she was being offered.
No. If these were the ones she took,
yeah.
I mean, imagine some of the ones she was being offered.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, they offered the role of Catherine Tramell to Kim Basinger, Julia Roberts, Greta Scacchi, Michelle Pfeiffer, Gina Davis, Kathleen Turner, Ellen Barkin, and Muriel Hemingway before they even got anywhere near.
Betty White.
Rue McClanahan, the other Golden Girl.
Jessica Tandy, Jeanette Cranky. They were all offered it.
Melvin Hayes. It would have been brilliant. Yeah, so, you know, she took on this role that no one else was sort of brave enough to take on. The only other character I can compare it to is sort of like Hannibal Lecter, in terms of just being utterly, obviously not for sex appeal reasons.
Yeah, he's gorgeous.
For being a total murderous psychopath, but just for being cold, intelligent, manipulative, and kind of the coolest, smartest person in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of making it a little bit seductive in that way.
Which is, to be fair, is easier to do in Basic Instinct, because everybody else is awful.
Oh my God.
When you're a character who's accused of being a violent murderer and you're not the worst person in it by 100 miles, you're going to be all right.
Yeah. God, they are all awful. And do you think Michael Douglas went in knowing that his character, it was ostensibly the sort of hero or the protagonist, the film noir, you know, flawed detective. Do you think he went in knowing that he is actually like an utterly repugnant, despicable, awful person?
Absolutely not.
Few redeeming qualities.
No. I honestly believe he thought he was the hero, the cool character. I don't think, if there was satire, and we are going back to that, I don't think he would have seen that edge in it at all. I think he thought it was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah, so apparently the two of them didn't really get on that well over the shoot. Sharon Stone said in an interview that they didn't really click. She said it was sort of like, it was good for the tension of the performances, but she said they never really got on too well.
Because it's hard to tell if there is any chemistry, again, because of the mundanity of the intimate scenes. Just how boring they are. You can't really tell if there is meant to be any chemistry or not.
The other thing that made this controversial at the time was that it was getting protested by the LGBTIQ community. There were lots of gay rights activists protests at the time because of the depiction of gay and bisexual characters. Not that our opinion matters, but what do you think of it?
I suppose the main issue in it is the relationship that Catherine has with Roxy.
Yeah.
It seems to me that it's playing on grubby male fantasy.
Yeah, a little
femme
bit.
Femme fatale, and they're dangerous, and it's all very lurid.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just think it's just taking the piss out of that. However, if I was part of that community, I may well see things differently. So,
yeah. I think the issue they had was, you know, the bisexual characters in the film were all pretty much murderers.
But again, they're not the worst people in it.
They're not. They're the coolest people in the film.
The straight white men are the worst people in it. And I did read somewhere that when the film was released, then opinions and perceptions did change from that community. And they kind of go, we get it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. They're definitely the most appealing people in the film. Murders or no.
So the film. The film opens with, like we said, a very sort of Hitchcock-style opening, a tracking shot of a very nice house, which we learn belongs to former rock and roll star Johnny Boz.
Johnny Boz, yeah. Really lovely Jerry Goldsmith score as well. Really good score.
Very good, yeah.
Oscar-nominated score. Yeah. Mm.
So we get these sweeps. We see a mirrored ceiling, sexy.
Yeah.
And a mystery blonde enjoying, and I put in my notes, unrealistic bouncy intercourse. And yes, that's not the last time I've written that in my notes.
Yeah.
But we can't see who it is, because the blonde here is covering her face, and I was looking at her face.
You can sort of tell who it is, though. I reckon you can tell. You can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, you can. Yeah. And so as part of their unrealistic bouncy intercourse, she ties him to the headboard with a white silk scarf and then indulges in an ice pick frenzy.
Yeah.
One goes through his nose, I noticed. The special effects were done by Rob Bottin.
Yeah, Rob Bottin, who've collaborated with Paul Verhoeven before, of course, John Carpenter, and probably the definition of the copies that I've been watching, but I'd never noticed that you clearly see that ice pick penetrating through the nose before.
Absolutely.
And just that look on his face, like, it's really good prosthetic. It's really good. Well,
yeah,
done.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Because when I saw his name on the opening credits, I thought, well, what is he going to be used for?
Mm.
And then I saw that ice pick through the nose and thought, yep, that's one. And then I guess the others were just trying to enhance Michael Douglas's saggy ass. Mr. Bottin did his work very well.
Yeah. And I think Gus's death, I think there's a bit of prosthetic work when he gets.
Yeah, that's pretty gory, yeah.
But yeah, good little phallic symbol there, a bit of a nice pit rogering your nose.
Yeah. So he's dead. Johnny Boz is dead.
Yeah, Johnny Boz is well dead. Yeah.
The next day, that bedroom is now a crime scene. Police are there and they're all horrible.
Yeah, yeah.
Acting like a bunch of lads, having a big laugh.
Yeah, and I really enjoy one of the lines in this scene. So Michael Douglas as Nick Curran and George Zunza as his lovable kind of offsider Gus. They have a slightly homoerotic relationship themselves, don't you think? Actually,
they clearly love one another, yeah.
They clearly love one another, and they call each other, Nick calls Gus Cowboy, and Gus calls Nick Huss, and they swagger into this crime scene, and one of the detectives who's taking photos, he just comes out with, there's cum stains all over the sheets. It's reminded me of my mum when she used to do my laundry when I was a teenager, basically.
Oh dear. Nick is notably impressed by the amount of material on the bed. And so the men are all very brashly and brazenly joking about sex. Very, very locker room. And I think that's kind of worth pointing out, because the way they react to a woman talking about the same subject later on is they kind of just go, oh, scary woman talking about sex.
Yeah. It's a very deliberate, sets up the contrast really nicely, doesn't it? They are just a whole bunch of just misogynist sort of idiots. Yeah, we see some lines of coke, which we find out later there were minute quantities on Johnny Boz's lips and penis.
I'd have used like a $20 bill personally.
I didn't think you could inhale through that, but
the thing I did notice here is, despite the frankly the abundance of bodily fluids, no one ever kind of goes, well, should we test for DNA? That would have solved the case immediately.
Yeah, because that was all happening back in 92, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, there was certainly a hell of a lot of DNA all over the sheets.
There was DNA all over the sheets.
all over the sheets.
But as well as commenting on the amount of DNA all over the sheets, they also learn that Johnny Boz's girlfriend is a lady named Catherine Tremell.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Nick and Gus go to her lovely house ask her some questions. It's very nice, very nice.
Mm.
And a mysterious, beautiful blonde starts sauntering down the stairs. And I guess in those days when we didn't really know who Sharon Stone was, it's feasible we could have been duped into thinking that was her.
It's quite a good little
It's a nice little dupe. It's slightly Hitchcocky. And again, we're looking at Vertigo and stuff like that with a doppelganger blonde, I suppose. It's a little nod to that.
Yeah, very much.
But it's not Catherine. Yeah, it's Roxy. She says, I'm her friend. And she may as well have done the quotation marks around the word friend the way that she said it.
Yeah, big wink. I'm her friend.
But Catherine's not there because she's at her even more amazing beach house.
Yeah, which is really cool, her beach house.
Yeah. So they talk to her and they're shocked at how open and brazen she is talking about enjoying sex. Again, it's that mirror image of men are allowed to laugh at it and talk about sex, but women aren't. When they do, it's threatening.
Yeah, and it's also, I guess, confronting the viewer as well, who would have seen any number of films with men joshing about talking like that in that first scene, and then many viewers would have been shocked to suddenly see Sharon Stone saying, oh, you know, he wasn't my boyfriend, I was fucking him, and I liked fucking him, and just
yeah.
to be...
Crikey, shocking. Yeah, because you would expect a damsel in distress, and she certainly isn't in distress for any moment in this film.
Just hugely charismatic. You can see why this role made a star of her, and, you know, very interesting character, and Nick is immediately intrigued.
Yes, he is. He is intrigued. So then we go to Dr. Beth Garner's office.
Mm.
Beth Garner, played by a debut role for Jean Triplehorn.
And what a surname. Triplehorn by name.
Yes. This is our second Triplehorn. Because, of course, we did Sliding Doors as well.
This is double horn.
Yeah, so she wears glasses, so she's academic.
She's a brunette.
She's stiff, she's repressed, she's a brunette, absolutely.
Yeah, she wears lots of earth tones, lots of browns, whereas, you know, the blondes all wear sort of black, white.
Mm.
Her and Nick have a bit of history, because people have been calling him Shooter.
Mm.
He's being investigated by Internal Affairs, and he's got a bit of a dubious past. And we soon learn that Nick, while high on coke... undercover, shot some tourists.
Yeah. It's a bit harsh.
Which is kind of... I forgot when I was watching this again, sort of, you know, because even as a kid, I think I was kind of like, oh, you know, he's the hero, he's our kind of goodie throughout most of the film. And watching it now, you think, yeah, he's been set up from the outset, really. It's pretty hard to redeem yourself from... being a coked up undercover cop who shoots some tourists.
Yeah. What do you think they were doing when he shot them? They're like backpackers and...
Well, yeah, I was trying to imagine it. You know, were they from the Netherlands? Just, I don't know, like... you know, I don't know.
Just asking for directions.
Trying not to kind of conjure up too many images of tourists. But yeah, who knows? And it's quite interesting, isn't it? They don't really give you any detail about it other than that he was... kind of coked up and shot some tourists, and he got off. A lot of films you would think maybe would give you a bit more, or even have him try and defend it. He never ever once tries to justify it or try and explain it or anything.
Yeah, they just say that she shot the tourists. That's it, really.
Yeah.
But she's kind of psychoanalyzing.
Yeah.
But she is also his ex. That is a conflict of interest, isn't it?
Whether it's a known secret or whether it seems to be pretty much out there.
Yeah.
That they've had this relationship. Yeah, I would think there'd be some really serious ethical, professional issues with having a psychological evaluation done by someone that you've just been shagging.
Yeah, but then they're not together anymore.
No.
But I think, you know, despite her being intelligent, beautiful, and I think about 20 years his junior, it's clear that she still misses his greasy, crumbly, unpleasant body.
Bum chin. I don't.
Perfect for snooker. It's great.
And this is quite funny. We've got to talk about Michael Douglas in this stage of his career, because I don't know what ego-driven quest he was on at this time where, you know, he's won an Oscar. So he's a hugely successful actor and producer. And then, you know, you had Fatal Attraction, which, well, yeah, it's a good thriller, you know. But then you had this film. Why would you do this film?
Mm.
And then... remember Disclosure? Remember he did Disclosure?
Oh, dear.
Where he was being sexually harassed at work by Demi Moore.
Yeah.
Let that sink in for a while. I mean, the ego that you have to have on you.
Yeah, well, he was 48 when he made this.
Mm.
That's slightly above midlife. It's a huge crisis. He still wants women to find him desirable. He was still a relatively handsome man.
Yeah,
but he still wanted the young ladies to crave his body.
Was he the first sort of sex addict that anyone ever heard of?
Yeah. Didn't he also say that his throat illness wasn't to do with his smoking? It was because of his cunnilingual skills.
It was.
Amazing. So I think we've answered your question about why he wanted to be in these films. Because he thinks he's brilliant at the sex.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not a terrible role, but yeah, strange one for sort of a very establishment, very well-respected, best actor Oscar-winning.
Yeah. Just wanted to have a bit of fun in inverted commas, I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the film. So they learn that Catherine, under a pseudonym of Catherine Wolfe, see what they've done there?
Yeah, Wolf, who's afraid of Catherine Wolfe? Yeah.
Mm, yeah. They've learned that she's written some bestsellers under that pseudonym, and in one of them, a rock star is murdered by his girlfriend with an ice pick.
Ooh, shit.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
It's a very loose biography of Trotsky.
Was he in Mexico at the time?
Yeah.
And I have to say, her books look like utter shit. If the cover art is anything to go by,
and
the titles.
Yeah.
So the book was called Love Hurts. I mean, okay. With like really crappy...
Well, I suppose they were published in the late 80s when things like that were...
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
More of a real
Flowers in the Attic vibe.
Yeah, yeah. So because of that, Nick's taking Catherine downtown.
Yeah.
Or he goes to see her and says that he's going to take her downtown. And while he's there, she says she's writing a new book about a detective who falls for the wrong woman and she kills him. It's not very subtle, is it?
No. Foreshadowing? She goes and gets changed and he just sort of stands there and watches her.
He just watches her. It's horrible. It's really horrible. I just wrote Jesus at that bit. But in the meantime, can we mention... There's a scene in the big police boardroom where they're trying to do an analysis of the murderer, and they bring in Ned Ryerson as the sort of as the psych expert.
He had a real career at this time. You know, he was popping up in a lot of films. And
his expert analysis is basically that either Catherine did it or somebody or
else
did.
But he has the best lines in the film, though. But, you know, I actually think this is really... You can laugh at the scene, but I actually think it's a really great scene because it totally sets up the whole dilemma or the whole kind of... the whole plot, you know?
Do you think I'd be stupid enough?
Yeah.
It's there, yeah.
See, the person who wrote the book is the murderer, or, like you say, someone else.
Someone else. Brilliant.
Who read the book and wants to frame her. So we're either talking about a devious, diabolical mind, we're talking about psychopathic, obsessive behaviour... Or, if it's someone trying to frame her, someone with deep-seated, obsessional hatred and utter disrespect for human life. Either way, it is someone very dangerous, someone very ill.
I love an utter lack of respect for human life. I think the ice pick up the nose gave that one away.
An utter disrespect for ice picks, too.
Yeah, utter. Yeah, oh, yeah. Don't go for drinks at their house.
But, you know, I actually thought, as kind of stupid as that scene is, it's like, great, this is the film. Is it her? Is it someone else? Either way, they're both pretty fucking fucked up people.
Okay. So the next scene, after Nick has taken Catherine downtown, of course, this is the scene that everybody remembers. There are a million memes and GIFs for.
Much parodied,
which is where Catherine is in this very strange, dark interview room. And she's being interviewed by several fat, sweaty, middle-aged men.
Wayne Knight.
Yeah, the guy who destroyed Jurassic Park. He's there, yeah.
Yeah, really well cast in this.
And again, they're clearly intimidated by... strong, attractive, confident women.
Yeah.
And they go a bit funny when she talks about sex.
I actually think this is a classic scene for a reason. I think it's actually a really good scene. Just the way she turns the tables on them. Not, you know, being able to look up her skirt, notwithstanding. You know, just the way she coolly just undoes them. And they're all just, sweating. And it's actually a really funny scene.
Yes, it is, yeah. Because I don't want to talk about that too much, because there's so many other more interesting things to talk about. But I did read that opinions are divided as to how that particular part of the scene came about. Joe Esterhaus said it wasn't in the original script. Sharon Stone said, I think it was like an actor's studio interview, that she didn't know it was being filmed this way, and that Paul Verhoeven told her to take off her pants because they were too bright and reflecting in the camera or something.
Her white undies were too reflective. Apparently she slapped them when she saw the rushes. And, she was shocked, absolutely shocked. But Paul Verhoeven denies that.
Yeah, he says he told her about it beforehand. And it would sort of, it would enhance her kind of free-spirited nature and the way she likes to toy with people.
It's a bit of a problematic scene in that regard, isn't it? Because of Rashomon-like backstory.
Yeah, but also I think because if it is a satire about misogyny and exploitation and male fantasy, whatever, which, you know, I sort of believe it is.
Yeah.
That, pardon the pun, it does sail a bit close to the wind, where She does that, and it does turn into actual exploitation, particularly if Sharon Stone's version of events are true. And I've no reason to disbelieve her.
No.
It does actually then go into that sort of exploitation that it's trying to satirize.
Yeah. And I mean, would it have been as sort of iconic without that moment? I mean, that moment is what drew all the attention, of course, because it's never been done before. But, you know, even without that, her performance in it is just so coolly in control and just charismatic and...
Yeah. Well, that kind of upstages her performance. That's the problem. That's all people talk about. And we're talking about it now, which is kind of ironic. But the remainder of her performance, it doesn't need that.
No.
I know I'm sounding quite stuffy, but it doesn't need it.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But it's just classic seeing all those macho male detectives just reduced to gibbering
sweaty
idiots.
Sweaty mess. Yeah.
And she's basically sitting there going, look, give me a polygraph.
Yeah.
Do whatever.
The polygraph's amazing.
Yeah.
They basically say to her, did you kill Johnny Boz? Nope. Thanks for your time.
Well, brilliant. You know, why beat around the bush?
So she's free to go. And then we're in like a cop's bar, the sort of bar where cops go to be noisy and talk about the case. Like McGinty's in Frasier. And despite Nick saying that he's given up drink, he's given up smoking, he's back on the booze and fags, Elizabeth sees him, Beth sees him, she's not happy. So then Nick has a fight with this guy called Nielsen.
Nielsen. He's the IA guy, right, that's on his case all the time.
Yes.
Of course, taunting him, being shooter. Nick's sort of been tainted by Catherine, hasn't he? His interactions with her, he's like going back to his vices.
Yes.
And has a bit of an altercation with Nielsen. It's one of those rare cop films where you're actually on the side of the IA guy who's investigating our hero.
Yeah, he should be put away. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So then Nick takes Beth home to his apartment, and this is where we get the first glimpse of Michael Douglas's saggy buttocks. I thought it's Rob Bottin's prosthetic arse. And this is horrible. This is a really horrible scene.
Yeah, so this scene is, if you haven't already kind of clicked on that Nick is a pretty highly flawed, pretty awful guy, probably deep down, this kind of removes all doubt. It's just a horrible.
It's disgusting. It's really horrible.
Well, he rapes Beth. Yeah,
he does. Which, yeah.
Are you supposed to, as a viewer, view it that way? Doesn't really matter. But yeah, I mean, she very clearly says no and does not consent.
There's a horrible instance where it's like, even though he's done that, she's got an expression of pleasure on her face, and you just think, this is again, it's just that disgraceful male fantasy thing.
Yeah. It's the lying together afterwards, and she's sort of a bit soppy kind of over him, and it's just gross. I actually even remember as a hormonal boy finding that scene a bit yuck.
It's incredibly unpleasant.
Also, no one really wants to see Michael Douglas's eyes roll in the back of his head like that.
Oh, no, thank you. Oh, dear me. Don't know, Catherine Zeta-Jones does it. But the only thing that's worth taking out of this scene as far as the plot goes, other than the fact that Nick's horrible, is that Beth confesses that she vaguely knew Catherine at Berkeley.
Yes.
That's probably just trivia. It won't be important later. Just a page
filler. No, yeah. I can't see that coming up.
So Nick is then back on Catherine's tail.
Is that a metaphor?
No. He's following her in a car.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm guessing that she knows she's being followed because, she even drives aggressively.
She does.
Watch out, lads.
Yeah,
I know. She's a scary lady. And he follows her to a house in the middle of San Francisco, which turns out to be the home of Hazel Dobkins. And it turns out that she's a murderer who killed her family.
She sort of sounds like a character in Harry Potter or something, Hazel Dobkins. Yeah. But
she works at the Leaky Cauldron, yeah.
Yeah, she offed her whole family. And this is the theme that starts coming up with all the women murderers in this movie, is that they're all... And they kind of make a point that it's motiveless with each one as well. It's just like they are basically rejecting traditional family or patriarchal constraints. So whether it's they're obliterating it, the traditional feminine expectations.
Yeah, because it's around about this time that we learn that Catherine's parents were killed in an accident in the 80s as well, when their boat exploded. So, yeah, I see what you mean. But, yeah, she does seem to hang around with female murderers. It's like a little club, isn't it?
It is like a little club. And even as we find out later in the film, you know, Roxy, when she was 16, off to all her little brothers.
So that little club gets bigger. So to alleviate the tension of the car chases and following her around, he just goes back to Catherine's house and watches her get undressed again. Because that's what a good cop does.
basically.
And then we learn of another murder associated with Catherine, that her lecturer at Berkeley was murdered in the 1980s. He was a professor. He was murdered in the lecture room with an ice pick. It's like Cluedo, the Basic Instinct edition.
It's a little bit.
I suspect. It just keeps adding up.
It does.
But he goes back to her house again to interview her, and he notices she's got an ice pick.
And do that many people have ice picks?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen one in my life, other than in Basic Instinct.
I've never, because obviously we see Nick using one later in the film. He buys us the big solid hunk of ice and then whacks at it. Yeah, I mean, we always just bought our party ice already in cube form.
Yeah. Does nobody have those little plastic molds that you put in the top of the fridge?
Yeah.
If people had those, there'd be a lot less dead bodies in San Francisco.
There would be.
So it's a simple thing.
Should be killing people with the little plastic mould, just whacking people on the head with a plastic mould.
You'd have to hit them a lot to kill them. You'd be sitting there just going, oh, God. So while he's there, we get aggressive flirty time from Catherine. She's coming on to him strong. Then she mentions his wife's suicide, which he's not too keen on. He doesn't really like that.
No. We do find out with the wife's suicide that she was driven to that basically by Nick's cocaine use and possibly the fact that he shot two tourists as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Put a bit of pressure on the relationship.
Well, they're so good for the economy.
And Catherine says, you got too close to the flame. You like the flame. Yeah.
So Nick's unhappy, mainly because his wife's suicide has been mentioned, but also then he's seen Catherine get off with somebody else. So he gets drunk again. He has a bit of a rant at Beth. She gives back her Bart Simpson keyring. That's her Bart Simpson keyring.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she confesses that she gave Nilsson Nick's psych file, kind of hinting that she'd been blackmailed for some reason.
Yeah. Nick's furious, isn't he? That, his private information has been... That Catherine does have access to that.
Yeah, a bit of Nick Fury there, yes.
Bit of Nick Fury. Yeah. Yeah.
One-eyed Nick Fury. We see some of that later. He's then woken up, and then he gets a call to say that Nilsson's dead.
Yes, because of course Nick's already, he's basically been sent home on gardening leave, hasn't he? Because he's actually gone into the police station and absolutely lost
his... He attacked Nilsson,
lost the shit at Nilsson.
So now the tables are turned, we're in the interrogation room, and Nick is now being questioned by a room full of fat, sweaty, middle-aged men. Yeah.
And thank God he's not wearing short shorts with no underwear or something
like that.
This movie would have been memorable for very different reasons.
One-eyed Nick Fury, yeah.
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 just a bollock hanging out of one one leg.
A dangly, pendulous bollock.
Yeah.
Oh my word.
Ball sack instinct.
Oh my word, I feel quite queasy now. That's not nice. So because of that they give Nick a little holiday. Because he's a suspect in a murder case and he's in too deep, etc. Nobody believes him, despite the overwhelming evidence that everyone near Catherine has been murdered and she's written down the reasons.
Yeah.
Nobody believes him, but he's certain that she's the murderer.
Yeah.
So when he goes home, she's there. And this is when she gives him a copy of one of her old novels, which is about a child who kills their parents and makes it look like an accident, as you do when you're the prime suspect for various murders.
Just to see if they can get away with it.
Absolutely. And so because he's convinced that she's a murderer and she's basically giving him hints, that she basically goes, she'll go out to a nightclub. She'll go clubbing.
And he then puts on the most inappropriate and uncomfortable outfit I can think of to wear to a sweaty nightclub. Of course, for the purposes of this podcast, it's fantastic to see, again, some knitwear.
It's a welcome back to Rob's knitwear.
It's welcome back to Rob's knitwear, but he wears a V-neck woolly jumper with nothing underneath it to a nightclub.
Yeah. Do you remember those memes where it was like a dad trying to embarrass his son by taking a selfie dressed like him?
Yeah. Why would you do that? You're either hot or you're cold. Like, it's why are you wearing a jumper with nothing underneath it? Who wants to dance in knitwear?
But it's V-neck. It's lime green. It's so unsuitable.
very low cut, a lot of Michael Douglas cleavage on display.
Oh, yeah, there is, yeah. And it is one of those nightclubs that doesn't really exist in real life. It only exists in movies. In other words, it looks good.
It looks really good, almost like a cathedral kind of with fluorescent lights everywhere.
Yeah.
Just packed out with beautiful people doing kind of really ostentatious dancing.
Thankfully, Nick isn't dancing.
Thank God.
And even when he and Catherine get on famously on the dance floor, he doesn't dance, he just stands there. Which, again, just shows he's clearly twice the age of everybody else in the room.
Yeah.
He doesn't really know what to do in a nightclub.
Yeah. And then they go home and...
another glimpse of Michael's big cheeks.
Yeah. He's just wearing his jumper. And his bum's poking out. It's so much...
If there was one thing worse than seeing Michael Douglas's cleavage in a nightclub, it's seeing that jumper with his bum sticking out the bottom.
Yeah, and then it's just a prolonged, quite tedious, very just...
It is really boring.
Really boring and really just unrealistic, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did make me laugh where he ventures south.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's keeping one eye on Catherine in case she stabs him in the face.
I don't know. I'd have performance issues if I thought I could be killed at any moment. But you know.
Well, completely. Yeah. It is a bit of a mood killer.
Yeah.
But luckily, he is so brilliant at it. Yeah. She doesn't stab him in the face.
Exactly.
You knew he'd be brilliant. He's so macho. He's so masculine. You knew he'd be brilliant in the bedroom.
Yeah.
So she then ties him to the headboard with a white silk scarf, you know, like the one her boyfriend, Johnny Balls was famously murdered while being tied with such a similar white scarf.
Yeah.
I'm not a prude. I'm not against a bit of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And what people do in the comfort of their own beach house is their own private affair, but it wouldn't have been prudish at this stage for Nick to go, no, thanks. I don't really want to do that. But he doesn't, and luckily his magnificent performance gets him through the night. What a man. And then afterwards, Roxy turns up and says, oh, I was watching that. If you touch her again, I'll kill you.
And it's when he says, look, I gotta tell you, Rocky, I think she's the fuck of the century. Okay, mate. All right, thanks.
Charming. That's his rebuttal.
Yeah.
Quite literally.
Yeah.
So then, because we know that Nick calls Gus cowboy, next time he meets Gus, he's dressed like a cowboy. He's drunk in some kind of shit-kicking bar, dressed like a cowboy. He's all about the confidentiality, so he boasts to Gus that he's had it off with Catherine.
Really appropriate.
Yeah. Gus isn't too keen on that, so Nick basically just lets him drive home drunk, as good policemen do.
Yeah, they have a scene, which I think is supposed to be kind of funny, where Nick takes him to like a diner or something, and Gus is really pissed and going, I can't believe you fucked her, man.
Mm.
And all these families look around going, oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, it's meant to be funny,
Then he had, like, a good friend. He lets Gus, who is just absolutely blind drunk, drive himself home. Yeah.
Yeah. And Nick really should have gone with him, because then he's immediately run over by a very fast car. But not hurt in any way.
I really laughed out loud at this bit, because he is thrown probably 15 feet in the air. Bounces off the tarmac. And just kind of looks up and just...
He's up straight away, So he gets in his car, and there's a nice San Francisco car chase. There's steep hills and steps and all that sort of stuff, which you'd expect from San Francisco. And then he comes face-to-face with the car that ran him over. So he plays a bit of chicken.
Yeah.
And then the car crashes off the bridge. And it's Roxy.
It's Roxy.
And she's dead. So then Nick's back at Catherine's house for some more fun and frolics. And this is where she drops a hint. She says that... she had a brief fling with in college who became a bit obsessed with her, so she had to report it to campus cops. But it's not going to be anyone that we know, because she's called Lisa Oberman, and that's not the same name as any of the people in this film. So, again, it's just a very loose bit of dialogue that we probably will never have a callback for.
No, I doubt that'll pay off in any way.
Nick, he picks up on that name, that Lisa Oberman. So he goes to Berkeley, to the campus police, or he phones up Berkeley and finds out there was no one ever there called Lisa Oberman.
No.
So he confronts Catherine, and she basically goes, duh, I said Hoberman, not Oberman.
Yeah, he's like, oh.
So Nick checks out Lisa Hoberman instead. And he finds out rather quickly that she changed her name to Elizabeth Beth Garner.
Ooh.
And just to prove the point, he compares two identical photos of Beth, one only different because it looks like someone sellotaped a big blonde wig over the top of it. It's exactly the same photo, but with a bit of blonde hair on it.
And it was a pretty fast computer for 1992. It only takes about 45 seconds for the photo to load onto the page. Yeah.
Good old dial-up. Fantastic. Yeah. So he naturally confronts Beth about Berkeley.
Yeah.
And she says, no, it's the other way around. Catherine obsessed after her.
Yeah.
And he sort of says, well, she didn't know who you were. How would she know? And she says to him, well, she knew you'd find out who Lisa Hoberman is. You're a good cop.
No, he's not.
He is the worst in policing.
Yeah. But he's got some good instincts. Basic instincts, if you will.
Basic ones, yeah. Very basic, yeah. So he goes to check the campus police for that report to see who's actually telling the truth. But it's gone. Taken by someone called Nilsson about a year ago.
Wow.
Interesting. So Nick sort of follows the lead. He goes to see Beth's ex-husband, but learns that he was killed in a drive-by shooting. The sheriff makes a point of saying it was a .38 revolver. I don't know why you'd include that, but he says it's a .38 revolver.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, another guy came around about a year ago asking the same thing, and he was called Nilsson. So Nick's getting very suspicious now.
Yeah.
So Nick's back at Catherine's house. He has a quick glance at Catherine's new book, which is conveniently coming out of the printer. And there's a bit that says his partner's been murdered and his legs are splayed out of the elevator door. But this doesn't raise any suspicion with him at all. He doesn't think, shit, everything else she's written has come true. Maybe I'd better check on Gus.
But
that's when Catherine basically says, well, you've served your purpose. I've written my book about the detective. Now you can just nick off.
She's very cold with him.
Yeah. And Hazel's there. And she's a little bit touchy-feely with Catherine, so are they?
Yeah, I don't know. They could be. It could be a bit of a May-December thing.
Mm.
Yeah, and she's very creepy, Hazel, too, I've got to say.
Yeah, she is, actually, yeah.
She's just a little bit over-familiar with Nick. Calls him Shooter.
Yeah, it's very cheeky, yeah. But in the meantime, Gus contacts Nick and says that he's had a call from Catherine's roommate, and she knows everything, and she wants to spill the beans about her and Beth. And he also learns another bit of evidence that Johnny Boz, remember him? He had a psychiatrist who shared an office with Beth. So all fingers are pointing towards Beth as being the killer.
Beth is not looking good for Beth.
It's not looking good for Beth. So he's called to a big building, and Nick, even though he's no longer a policeman, he goes along too. Even though he's desperate to crack the case, he just waits outside in the car, and Gus goes in alone.
He's basically catatonic, isn't he, after Catherine dumps him. So he's sitting there in the car while Gus is basically saying all this exposition and basically we're cracking the case, da-da-da-da. Yeah, Nick's just sitting there just catatonic because he's been dumped.
And then Gus kind of goes up and down in an elevator for a bit.
And that's when Nick goes, shit,
oh my God.
Yeah.
Why does he go, oh my God? Is it because he's seen somebody, or is it because he's going up and down in an elevator, he remembers the manuscript?
I think it's the elevator, because I think the shot immediately preceding that is you see the lights of the elevator kind of ascending up the building and the elevator shaft, and it's almost like he's just finally, the penny's dropped. But it's not hugely clear. It doesn't really work, him just sitting in the car, totally zoned out because he's had his heart broken.
But if it is B, and he remembered the manuscript, which effectively said, I'm going to kill Gus in an elevator, why does he no longer suspect Catherine? That's her signed confession.
Because he's decided to... All the other evidence that's pointing towards Beth now outweighs...
But how would Beth have read that thing in an elevator?
How would Beth have read that? Yeah.
It would either have been Catherine or Hazel. Nobody else would have seen that. It's a draft.
In the words of Nick Ryerson, it would either be Catherine or someone else.
Or someone else, yeah. Well, it does then throw one of Ned Ryerson's theories out the window about people who've read the book, because nobody would have read it.
Yeah. Perhaps that's something for people who are paying attention...
So he rushes to Gus's aid, but too late, because Gus is horribly stabbed with an ice pick by a hooded figure, and Nick finds him with his legs splayed out of the elevator, just like in the book.
If Brian De Palma had made this, you know, it would be the Michael Caine or John Lithgow in that wig and, and trench coat.
Or a bloke with bad Native American makeup on.
Automatically making it much more powerful, but yeah.
So if Gus had taken the stairs, he wouldn't have been killed, would he? Because that's not in the book.
He's a big guy. It would have been hard to drag him up to the elevator to pose it the way,
So he finds Gus dead in the lift, and Beth's there. And she says she had a message to meet Nick there.
Yeah. She sort of goes to reach into her pocket and he just sort of does a shouty Nick thing and just shoots her.
He runs
up to her body and he sees that she's pulling out her keys, the bar key ring. And he is immediately just devastated that, shooter has shot someone again. Hey, at least this time it wasn't a tourist. It was a local.
It was a local, yeah. He doesn't discriminate.
No.
And then the police are there and they find a blonde wig and like a sort of a pack-a-mac, a police issue pack-a-mac on the stairs, which again points towards Beth because she works out of the police station. And then when they search Beth's flat, there's more damning evidence. There's Catherine's books. There's a lot of magazine articles about Catherine. There's a .38 revolver,
yeah,
which of course they'd mentioned previously. And this graduation photo.
Yeah, graduation photo, yeah.
Which looked like it was taken that morning. Because they just look exactly the same.
Yeah.
I suppose they just didn't go into the wardrobe and find a big T-shirt that had "I done it" printed on the front. Because it's... In Minority Report, that's what Colin Farrell refers to as an orgy of evidence.
There's so much damning evidence,
it certainly can't be true.
Yeah.
But the police think, well, yep, that case against Beth, it's gathered enough momentum. And so they basically say, yeah, she probably did it then.
And no one goes, hang on, how did she read this novel that certainly hasn't come out yet? But okay.
Yeah, exactly. No, that doesn't occur to anyone. Or they don't test her DNA against Johnny Boz's stain sheets or anything like that. So Nick is now a hero. They're all shaking his hand saying, well done, you cracked the case, shooter. So he goes back home and Catherine's there. Because despite the fact that he's old and...
awful.
Wears a V-neck with nothing underneath.
Literally nothing underneath.
Literally nothing underneath. He's so brilliant at the sex.
Yeah.
She can't lose him. She can't do without him. So, of course, they engage in some more athleticism.
And her previous coldness was just because she doesn't want to get close to people. Because
they end up dead.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, presumably because Nick's so good at it, probably about 9 hours afterwards, because he is veering on the tantric, they talk about living happily ever after while effing like minks.
Yeah. Well, he does. That's his vision for the future.
And while they're talking, she keeps kind of reaching off the edge of the bed for something. And there's about 5 instances of, is she going to kill him? No! Mm. Things going on all the time. And so then they decide, I think, to be an item. And so they indulge in a final piece of frenzied lovemaking before the end credits. As they're cracking on with it, the camera sort of slowly pans down. And there's an ice pick under the bed.
God, why would you have an ice pick under the bed?
I know. It's a clumsy place to leave it. You could get out of bed bare feet. You could stand on that if you weren't wearing your slippers.
Of course, 14 years later, the belated sequel came out, Basic Instinct 2.
Cruise Control. It's called something like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which I haven't seen. Citizens on Patrol.
Yeah, Basic Instinct 2, The Revenge. David Morrissey is in it.
Yes. David Morrissey and David Thewlis, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really awful. Although it does have its fans. I think Mark Kermode gave it a good review.
Wow.
But of course, there's no Nick, is what I'm alluding to. There's no.
Yes.
Presumably, he's dead.
Mm. Yeah. So that is the end of the film.
It is.
Yeah. Are we to assume that she was then planning to kill Nick?
Yeah.
But didn't, because he sort of bonked the killer out of her.
Well, I think she didn't that night, you know, because she kills them when she gets bored of them.
Yeah.
You know? Right now, he's still pretty interesting.
Because she said, like, Mr. Shooter dies at the end of the book.
Yeah.
How did he die?
Well...
if it's not by ice pick, he's not out of the woods yet, is he?
No. So I just think it's a stay of execution, not a... Yeah.
Yeah. He should read it.
Yeah, he really should. Roger Ebert, when he reviewed this, he gave this sort of a, I think it was kind of like a 2.5 or something. He thought it was a real cheat. Basically, you could have your cake and eat it too. If you like Catherine Tramell, you could go away thinking it was Beth. But if you wanted to see Catherine Tramell as the killer, then obviously it's there for you. I think it's pretty unambiguous that actually it's Catherine Tramell.
Well, yeah, she did it. Absolutely.
Yeah, she absolutely did it. Mm. So Roger, you know... Roger, mate, come on.
This isn't like The Thing where at the end you're trying to work out which one's The Thing and which one isn't. It's pretty clear cut.
Now, that would have been great if she'd reached down to under the bed and Kurt Russell was just under there. That would have been...
see what happens.
That would have been so good.
Well, I'm certainly glad we didn't see Michael Douglas's Thing. I'm very pleased about that.
So did Catherine... set out to do all of this purely to get Beth killed.
Well, it's a very long game, isn't it?
Yeah, it makes Javier Bardem's character in Skyfall, you know, Silver, look like a fucking novice.
Quite impulsive, yeah.
You know, why didn't she just kill Beth? You know, I guess maybe she wanted to destroy her reputation as well.
Maybe, yeah.
Wouldn't have made quite as good a plot of a book if it was just novelist drives to psychiatrist's house and shoots her.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I do have one more question.
Yeah.
Which is, Rob, is Basic Instinct still any good?
Well, on the rewatch of this, I have to say, I thought it cracked along at a fair pace. I was quite entertained by it. I kind of enjoyed it, to be honest. The parts that were the most tedious for me were the protracted sex scenes.
Yeah.
And at the end, in that third act, they try and throw so much plot at you that they hope you don't quite keep up with the fact that it makes absolutely no sense at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it a good film, objectively? I think it's pretty stylish. I think there's some good performances in it. I think it's a really B-grade story. I can't understand for the life of me how the script sold for $3 million. Because if you take away the fairly explicit sex scenes, which at the time were quite groundbreaking, you take away Sharon Stone's, you know, star-making performance and the nice little competent, slick direction of Paul Verhoeven, you take that away, the script is pretty B-grade. So it's kind of a reluctant, I enjoyed it, but I'm very aware of its many failings.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can appreciate what he was trying to do, and it is probably cleverer than it looks. He's clearly having a go at traditional Hollywood male attitudes and misogyny.
Absolutely. Sexual politics.
Yeah. So I can see where he's coming from, so to speak. But
that's what she said, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really boring.
Yeah.
I thought the script was stupid. Yeah. Very much like you. The whole selling point of it at the time was these amazing sex scenes. They are so dull.
Yeah, they are dull.
They are really boring. Really dull. It's very, very well shot. Good photography from Jan de Bont.
Yeah, of course.
Who obviously went on to direct things like Speed.
Yeah.
Sharon Stone's performance is just a powerhouse. Yeah. She absolutely owns the film. But no, I couldn't say I enjoyed it. I thought it was way too long. It just went around in circles.
Yeah, I agree. It was 20 minutes at least too long. It could have been a 95-minute film.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be something to do with the fact that I've got a three-month-old baby and I don't watch many things. This is actually the first movie I've
You needed the mental stimulation.
Watched in probably like a couple of months.
You were just grateful for the company.
I was a little bit. Pretended shooter was my friend. We'd go off on adventures shooting tourists together. Well, if we had any. The other thing I think there was some bold deconstruction of the sexual politics there. And I do think there was something that he was trying to say about women taking down the patriarchy with the fact that all the women murderers were all killing, you know, those traditional familial or patriarchal confines that they have.
Yeah.
So he was saying something. I think Brian De Palma would have done a better job of this. I love Brian De Palma. I think he's still my favourite Hitchcock homage merchant. I'm going to say, I have to choose, don't I? It's honestly good, yeah.
Okay, so I'm just below that. I'd say average.
All right.
So if you add those together, it is quite good.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Right, we are probably about done because it's bloody late.
It is bloody late. What have we got next? What's your choice next?
This is one that we talked about before lockdown and before you went off to have your baby. Yeah. And it's a Steve Martin comedy.
Ooh.
It has been in the headlines a little recently because the writer and director passed away, Carl Reiner. So I'd like to have a look at The Man with Two Brains.
Fantastic. Mm. Yeah, I'd love to see this again.
I haven't seen it for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I haven't seen it for, God, probably 25 years, even a little bit more. And I remember hugely enjoying it as a child, so yeah.
Same here. So, I'm looking forward to that one.
Cool. Good choice.
Right, let's do some housekeeping. If you want to get in touch with us, we are on Twitter @StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, Still Any Good Pod.
We're also on Facebook, Still Any Good. And if you want to email us, we're at stillanygood@gmail.com.
Yeah, and, you know, we'd love it if you'd rate and review us or write a little nice little comment or, yeah, just a review. It's always lovely to see your feedback and it'd be great.
It's nice to know you're out there. So, yeah, please do. Please get in touch. It's always nice.
Fantastic.
Okay, time to wrap it up then. So it's time to say our goodnights and I'll see you soon.
Good night.
Good night, folks. Cheers.
See you. It is a just piece of film history, and that's just my dog. My dog shaking. It's not me doing anything untoward. Thinking about the scene.
That's amazing.
But you know, without that, her performance in it is just so. That's Zoe now drinking water.
That's amazing.